From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, we have the latest on crucial talks in Geneva as John Kerry jets in to drive home a deal over Iran's nuclear intentions. Also today, as President Obama apologises over the healthcare fiasco, we go to the state of Colorado, where more than 250,000 people have been affected.
It's a trend that is certainly being seen around the country, but it certainly seems it's being amplified here in Colorado.
We look at the future for 60 minutes after Lara Logan apologises over the programme's botched Benghazi report. And as another model catches fire, we look at the problems putting the brakes on the future of electric car maker Tesla.
It's all perspective. Is this a test moment for Tesla? Sure. Will they get past it? They've gotten past worse. Gasoline cars today would never be approved as an idea.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. All eyes remain on Geneva, where U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is meeting Iranian leaders amid growing expectations that an agreement could be struck over the country's nuclear aspirations. The Secretary of State arrived for unscheduled talks with the Iranians, and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov says he will travel to Geneva on Saturday. Analysts say Iran may agree to freeze expansion of its nuclear activity in exchange for limited relief from US-led sanctions. Mr. Kerry told reporters there are long hours of negotiation ahead.
I want to emphasize there is not an agreement at this point in time, but the P5 is working hard, and I look forward to the meetings that I'll be having very shortly. We hope to try to narrow those differences.
The U.S. television network CBS is apologizing to viewers for broadcasting an apparently bogus account about last year's attack on the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya. A security contractor claimed on the flagship program 60 Minutes that he was present during the attack, which killed the U.S. ambassador and three others last year. From FSN's Washington Bureau, Daniel Wrenches reports.
The security contractor Dylan Davies' credibility has this week been undermined by the fact that he claimed to be on the scene, fought off an attacker, and saw the body of Ambassador Christopher Stevens in a hospital bed on the night of the incident on the US compound last year. But Davies told FBI investigators that he was holed up in a nearby villa and didn't arrive until the following morning, forcing the 60 Minutes reporter Lara Logan to apologize on air.
He said that he told the FBI the same story that he had told us. But what we now know is that he told the FBI a different story.
His account on the program broadcast on October the 27th aligned with a story in a book he published under a pseudonym by one of CBS's publishing arms.
The U.S. economy added 204,000 jobs in October, a figure well above expectations, according to the latest figures from the Labor Department. The unemployment rate also rose to 7.3%, most likely as a result of the U.S. government shutdown. France's credit rating has been reduced a notch from AA+ to AA. The credit rating agency Standard & Poor's, who announced the downgrade, says slow economic reforms and a lack of growth are to blame. FSN's Kate Moody reports from Paris.
S&P said high unemployment of around 11% is affecting government efforts to boost growth and reduce deficit spending. In theory, a lower credit rating means the government's borrowing costs will rise. François Hollande's government said S&P had made an inaccurate judgment and insisted that the government had made major strides towards fixing the economy.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. A British Royal Marine has been found guilty of the murder of an insurgent in Afghanistan. A military court heard the prosecution describe the killing in 2011 as an execution. It was inadvertently filmed by another Marine on his helmet-mounted camera. It's the first time British forces have faced a murder charge related to their operations in Afghanistan. The convicted Marine will be sentenced next month. Brig Dunham, Deputy Commandant of the General Royal Marines, condemned the crime.
It is a matter of profound regret, in this isolated incident, that one Marine failed to apply his training and discharge his responsibilities. What we have heard over the last 2 weeks is not consistent with the ethos, values and standards of the Royal Marines. It was a truly shocking and appalling aberration. It should not have happened and it should never happen again.
Jordan looks set to take up the vacant seat on the United Nations Security Council following Saudi Arabia's rejection of the position last month. If formally agreed, Jordan will start the two-year term in January. From FSN's bureau at the UN in New York, Nick Harper reports.
Jordan looks set to take up one of the seats on the Security Council, the UN's most powerful body. The Associated Press quotes an unnamed diplomat who says Jordan's ambassador to the UN has flown to the country for talks on the subject. In an unprecedented move, Saudi Arabia turned down the seat normally reserved for Arab nations on the council in October. It would mean Jordan would take up one of the 10 elected seats in the 15-member state council, holding the position for a two-year term. When Jordan's intention is formally announced, the UN General Assembly will then vote to approve it, something which is likely to pass without much opposition. Nick Harper, New York.
There's more from us on Twitter. You can follow us there at Feature Story. And that is the latest Feature Story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. US Secretary of State John Kerry has interrupted his Middle East tour and is in Geneva amid signs that a deal over Iran's controversial nuclear program may be reached on Friday. US officials in Geneva have already approached Iran with a potential compromise over the matter. AlMonitor.com reporter Laura Rosen is in Geneva for the second day of talks and says the arrival of top international diplomats sends a clear message of intent.
This morning we've seen a procession of three European foreign ministers, and about 3 hours ago, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry arrived from Tel Aviv, where he'd gotten an earful in the morning from the Israeli Prime Minister, warning him not to sign a deal. Now Kerry, the lead EU negotiator, have been joined by the Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif. Just a couple minutes ago he left to have a trilateral. It's about 6 p.m. here, so we're going to see if they're able to come out and tell us they have an agreement tonight, or it's very likely there could be follow-on talks tomorrow.
And what exactly do we think is being discussed in terms of a compromise over Iran's nuclear program?
As the Iranian foreign minister told me and others in interviews last night, they're talking about a three-part kind of framework agreement. A statement of common objectives for the resolving the issue, agreeing on a first step, which would be temporary suspension, say 6 months, of some of Iran's most worrying nuclear activities, and using that 6 months then to negotiate an end state deal or comprehensive deal, which would offer fuller sanctions relief for more restraints and verifications on Iran's nuclear program.
This is being widely viewed by diplomats as a first step on what's going to be a much longer process.
That's right. So what you do is you basically get a time out kind of on some of Iran's expansion of its program, and you know, in this first step deal, in order to use that to negotiate the harder stuff, the longer deal, in which Iran wants things like recognition of its right to enrich and things like that.
But doesn't the fact that so many top diplomats have flown into Geneva for this second day of talks suggest that something's about to happen?
Right, although I will say that both Kerry and the French foreign minister upon his arrival, Fabius, made a point of saying, look, you know, there's progress, but there's not a done deal. This is not a kind of kabuki negotiation, that there's stuff still to be agreed. I think also it's important for the most senior diplomats from these countries to be here signing off on things, not just the number two, number three diplomat, given the sensitivity of the issue. You've heard the Israelis, the Saudis, and others, you know, express concern that this is getting Iran too much. So you need kind of high-level people to make sure that, you know, their leaders want to sign off on this.
In Geneva, that was reporter for AlMonitor.com, Laura Rosen. In light of Kerry's arrival, FSN's Daniel Renches spoke to Trita Parsi, founder and current president of the National Iranian American Council, and asked him about the US Secretary of State's approach to these latest round of nuclear talks.
I think that they have an agreement on the larger framework, but then there's going to be initial steps in which I think there's a desire from both sides to make sure that they're not giving too much in the early phases of this deal so that they have less leverage when it comes to the second and perhaps third phase of the deal. There's a bargaining that is taking place right now, which is typical towards the end of a negotiation. I think, however, when it comes to the broader parameters of the deal, there is an agreement. I don't think we would have seen Secretary Kerry, and certainly not Foreign Minister Lavrov from Russia, go to Geneva. He's going to arrive there tomorrow, according to the news. I don't think we would have seen that unless they had come very, very close to a deal.
Do you think that deal includes the ability to monitor consistently the two major uranium enrichment plants in Iran?
Well, the two sites that are there are already being monitored. In fact, they're the two most monitored sites that the IAEA is dealing with. What we need, however, is further monitoring of having the additional protocol ratified and implemented by the Iranian that gives the IAEA the opportunity to go and do spot checks on undeclared sites. That's the best instrument we have to make sure that there isn't a secret program.
The Israelis are highly skeptical. They think the international community is being duped by this.
I don't think the international community is being duped. And I think, to be completely frank, that Prime Minister Netanyahu is not being entirely honest. He is doing what he has to do from his political perspective. I think he knows very well he's not going to change the parameters of the deal. I think he also knows by now that he's not going to be able to scuttle it. And he also knows that this actually is a good deal. It's a good deal for Israel, because if there is an improvement of relations between the United States and Iran, inevitably that will also lead to the Iranians softening their position on Israel. And that is good for Israel.
We know that there's been domestically in Iran, a rearrangement of the political emphasis on engagement with the US and the international community. Has there been an equal and opposite engagement of a different kind, a sea change in Washington?
I think the president has been leading an effort to get that type of a sea change. I would have to say that I follow this issue very closely. I've written a book about what Obama has done on Iran. And I've never seen the president and his entire administration being so dedicated, so committed to a deal, to a negotiation process, and be willing to take the heat from Israel, from Congress, from Saudi Arabia, in order to get what they know is a very good deal.
Could this impact the proxy war that's happening in Syria, or will all that complexity still be in the pot?
The complexity will be there, but there will be new opportunities to actually address it effectively. At the end of the day, you cannot have a deal, a sustainable deal in Syria, without having the Iranians and having the Saudis involved. I think opportunities will open up.
Trita Parsi talking to FSN's Daniel Wrenches. "60 Minutes" correspondent Lara Logan has been forced to admit she was misled in her recent report on last year's Benghazi attacks.
You know, the most important thing to every person at 60 Minutes is the truth. And today the truth is that we made a mistake. Nobody likes to admit that they made a mistake. But if you do, you have to stand up and take responsibility, and you have to say that you were wrong. And in this case, we were wrong.
Ms. Logan interviewed Dylan Davis, a security contractor who has since provided conflicting accounts of his role during the attack on the US special mission in Libya. Earlier, I spoke to David Zarewick, media critic for the Baltimore Sun, and he began by telling me just how catastrophic this could be for 60 Minutes.
Well, here's the thing about 60 Minutes that's, I think, so important. In the history of American television, network American television going back to 1948, there has not been a more successful television show, both in terms of the amount of money it's made for the network, and that's because it airs in primetime when the highest rates are charged, but also its journalistic reputation. It really is the sort of linchpin of CBS 60 Minutes News. So CBS News can have the last place evening newscast, the CBS Evening News with Scott Pelley, and it can have the last place morning show, and the network news division is still profitable, and 60 Minutes is the cash cow. So it's the rare thing in American television these days. It's both got prestige and it makes money, but all of that is tied to its credibility. The fact that people believe it, and because it finds stories no one else has. Some of them are shocking, but the American television audience on Sunday night believes it. If you erode that credibility, which a story like this clearly does, you are really messing with the franchise. You are really threatening the franchise for the news division and for the whole network, because it contributes so much money to that bottom line. You know, this isn't as bad as when Dan Rather reported on George W. Bush's military record with an unconfirmed report that he could later not verify, and then stonewalled. But, you know, it's been October 27th, and now it's November 8th, so that's 10 or 11 days that CBS News has not pulled away from this report, as various watchdog groups and other news agencies like the Washington Post reported the very problems it acknowledged today.
Do you think Lara Logan's apology, her retreat today, is going to do enough to try and stop that erosion of credibility, as you put it?
I don't. I mean, you know, it's obviously better to, once you know for sure, totally to come forth, apologize, correct the record, all of the things she tried to do this morning on the air. But it's not that easy. It's never that easy that, oh, okay, I apologize, now everything's fine. The credibility took a hit, but it's worse in this case, in this sense. And I wrote in my blog that it's compounded exponentially by this. Benghazi is a lightning rod for controversy in American culture right now because Americans died there. So, no, I don't think this goes away overnight. And I have to tell you, as a media critic who's been doing this for a couple of decades, I am surprised that 60 Minutes, with all the vetting standards they say that they have in place, that they could get taken in by this guy.
David Zarewicz of the Baltimore Sun. And you can see his writings on the CBS 60 Minutes apology on the newspaper's website, baltimoresun.com. This is FSN Reports.
I am sorry that they, you know, are finding themselves in this situation based on assurances they got from me.
President Obama telling NBC News that he's sorry for yet more problems over the implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Within the last few days, millions of Americans have learned that they will not be able to keep their current health insurance policies, despite promises to the contrary by the Obama administration. The problem has been especially acute in the state of Colorado, where more than a quarter of a million people received cancellation notices from their insurance companies through the mail this week. FSN's Denver Bureau Chief Steve Mort has been reporting the story and told Simon Marks that the situation is causing real concern in the state.
We've been hearing many stories from many Colorado residents about these policies being cancelled. Mainly, the insurance companies that are cancelling these policies are Kaiser Permanente and Anthem, which is an arm of the major insurance company Blue Cross Blue Shield. They're the two big insurers in Colorado. And what we're hearing so far is that some quarter of a million people in this state have received letters to say that their insurance policies are being cancelled because they no longer meet the requirements of the Affordable Care Act. And when you think about it, it's a state of just 5 million people. So a quarter of a million people is really a substantial number of people that have received these cancellation notices. And it's a trend that is certainly being seen around the country, but it certainly seems it's being amplified here in Colorado.
And just to be clear about the reasons why these policies have been cancelled, is in most cases because they don't meet the minimum terms required under the Affordable Care Act.
Yes, that's right. And what many of the insurance companies are doing is instead of saying, well, what we'll do is we'll add services to current policies, maybe charge a bit more, what they're saying is these policies no longer meet the requirements. Essentially, what they're saying is these policies are now illegal under the Affordable Care Act. We don't provide the services that are necessary, that are mandated by that act, by Obamacare, and therefore these policies are no longer valid. What you're going to have to do is you're going to have to go online, shop for these policies, shop for things that do meet the requirements of the Affordable Care Act, and maybe not, you can find something sort of similar that is going to have a sort of a similar kind of premium payment. But what a lot of people are saying that we've spoken to is, you know, we go online, we find something, but it's less coverage for more money. And of course, it doesn't kick in until the beginning of the year. And even though that's the case, you know, despite the fact that there has been a quarter of a million cancellation notices, only about 3,400 people in Colorado have actually successfully managed to sign up for insurance policies that are due to begin at the beginning of the new year. Like the federal exchange, the Colorado State Exchange, it was one of the states that actually opted to have its own healthcare exchange. That's been fraught with problems as well. I've been through the process. I've sort of looked online. It takes a long time, upwards of an hour, to get to the process where you can actually select a plan. So it's a cumbersome process. It's a difficult process, and only 3,400 people so far have signed up.
Now, President Obama has apologized. He says that he has heard the complaints from Colorado and from the other states where this is occurring, and he's going to address the situation. Has that in any way tempered the public reaction to what's taking place?
No, not really. But I think it's important to emphasize the fact that not everybody is having a really hard time with this. You know, just yesterday, I met with a cancer patient who's undergoing chemotherapy for bone marrow cancer. Her husband lost his job and is currently receiving his health insurance through COBRA. That's the way you can keep your employee health insurance, but at the full rate with no employer contribution. And that'll last through the end of the year. And her lifeline is the fact that she can get insurance through the health exchanges to start or to continue her chemotherapy after the new year.
Steve Mort, FSN's Bureau Chief in Denver. The M23 rebel group in the Democratic Republic of Congo have begun surrendering their weapons, days after announcing they would lay down their arms following a 20-month rebellion. It's a success for the Congolese army, but also for the 20,000 UN peacekeepers in the country. Our UN correspondent has the story.
In recent days, Congolese forces captured the remaining hilltop rebel strongholds in the eastern part of the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, a defeat that convinced the M23 leader to call for an end to the armed rebellion. After a briefing from the head of the UN peacekeeping mission, called MONUSCO, France's UN ambassador welcomed the news.
This is a success for the Congolese army, but also, of course, for the UN and the MONUSCO, which has acted on the basis of Resolution 2098, which had been tabled and proposed by France.
UN blue helmets, as the peacekeepers are sometimes called, have been stationed in the DRC for decades to keep the peace. Facing a stubborn insurgency, the UN Security Council last March created intervention brigades, a division of peacekeepers armed with heavy weaponry and charged with taking the fight directly to insurgents. Peacekeeping expert Arthur Botellis says the bulk of the credit belongs to the Congolese army and that the military victory now lays the groundwork for a political resolution to the conflict.
I think the fact that the intervention brigade, together with the reinforced FARDC, basically showed overwhelming force, maybe, I'm now speculating, may have played a part in the M23 basically retreating and eventually surrendering. The use of force in a peacekeeping context especially can be useful at a tactical level to create space for a political process, right? It can be useful as a deterrent as well.
The two sides plan to sign a peace deal on Monday, marking an official end to a conflict that's displaced hundreds of thousands of people. But even with the M23 surrender, Security Council members are well aware the fight isn't finished. Here's China's permanent representative to the United Nations, Ambassador Liu.
The situation is still very complex on the ground. We do realize that it is not the end of the road if we work out an agreement between the government of the DRC and M23. There are other groups that are still in the region.
Rwanda is now pushing for Congolese and UN forces to turn their sights on the FDLR rebel movement, comprised of ethnic Hutus involved in Rwanda's 1994 genocide. The UN repeatedly accused Rwanda, however, of supporting the now demilitarized M23 movement. Quinn Bowman, New York.
American motorists are often characterized abroad as driving big gas-guzzling cars, but one electric car maker, Tesla, has been getting a foothold in the US market. Unfortunately for them, drivers have now reported a string of fires in Tesla models. 3 in 5 weeks, the latest just this Wednesday in Tennessee, when a fire broke out after Tesla hit debris on a road. The company says the previous two incidents were also the result of accidents, but the firm's shares fell over 7% on Thursday. FSN's Lorna Shaddick has been speaking to electric car advocate Chelsea Sexton, best known for her role in the documentary Who Killed the Electric Car, and started by asking her what impact these fires could have on Tesla's sales.
So far, I've not seen evidence that it's actually impacted the market at all, nor even the opinions of folks that are following electric vehicles. What it has done potentially is impact the stock, although the stock had already been on such a run, it's hard to separate how much is to do with these news stories and how much is sort of natural correction of the stock itself. But certainly it's generating a lot of headlines and a lot of stress for Tesla and, by extension, electric vehicles in general.
Indeed. How popular are electric cars here? Is there a market for them? And what are consumers getting for their money here?
Actually, electric vehicles have been rather popular in the United States and even globally for several years now. There will probably be roughly 90 to 100,000 of them sold in the U.S. this year. It's worth noting that while there are about a dozen different models available, there's only a few that are actually available nationwide. But those that have their electric cars love them. And even these three people who've all had their Model S's totaled by these accidents have all said they believe the vehicle saved their lives and they want another one. So once we see people go electric, they don't go back.
Do electric cars really have a future here? And does Tesla in particular have a future given this this publicity?
Our automotive culture is built around the idea of road trips and Route 66 and, you know, range equaling freedom. At the same time, the reality is that the vast majority of people drive less than 40 miles a day. And gasoline, even in the U.S., although certainly not compared to other countries, is rather expensive for most people. So many are coming around to the idea of either having a vehicle for Monday through Friday and driving the gas car on the weekends, or simply just driving electric and renting a gas car when they need one, or flying to wherever they're going long distance. It's sort of the right tool for the job mentality is starting to enter into the American auto market even before electric cars.
So you think despite these mishaps with cars and the publicity that surrounded them, more and more people will ignore that anyway and decide to go for an electric car in future?
It's all perspective. Is this a tough moment for Tesla? Sure. Will they get past it? They've gotten past worse. Gasoline cars today would never be approved as an idea. Imagine someone saying to you, I'd like you to drive around this few thousand-pound object that has 10 to 20 gallons of very flammable liquid inside of it, that the moment it ignites becomes a bomb. If this was introduced today, we'd never go for it. But we're so used to it that when something happens in an electric car, it's so foreign and so strange, and yet the reality is it's been so much safer. If these metal objects had punctured a gas tank, that car would have exploded on the spot. In the Model S, the driver was able to keep driving. He was able to pull the car off the road, get out of the car and away from it before any fire actually happened. So, you know, it's a little bit of what's the priority in the grand scheme. So far, electric vehicles have proven to be much safer than their gasoline counterparts.
Electric car expert Chelsea Sexton talking to FSN's Lorna Shaddick. And that's the Friday edition of FSN Reports. Monday is Veterans Day, and we're bringing you a special edition of the programme featuring an extended interview with journalist Ray Suarez, author of Latino Americans and host of the PBS series of the same name. He talks to us about the dynamics of America's fastest growing demographic group.
It will add millions to the voter rolls, to the workforce, to the list of homeowners in America. It's going to really change how we think of ourselves and what we think of when we say, imagine an American.
That's Ray Suarez on Monday's edition of FSN Reports. But for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks. For everyone with feature story news everywhere, have a great weekend. Goodbye.